listening to a special podcast from the Pod Delusion. In this lecture, you'll hear Professor Kevin Work from the University of Reading speak about the cyborg experiments. This lecture was recorded at the National Museum in Cardiff as part of the British Humanist Association's Conference 2012. To introduce the talk, here is BHA Trustee Robert Ashby.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name, as Andrew has said, is Robert Ashby. I'm Chair of the Board of Trustees, and my job this morning, first thing, is to introduce our first lecturer, Kevin Warwick, who's sitting just by me here, a man who has said there can be no absolute reality, there can be no absolute truth. I'm not quite sure how this gels with our humanist belief in truth and reality, but no doubt we'll find out during the lecture. Kevin is a professor of cybernetics at the University of Reading in England, where he carries on research in artificial intelligence, control, robotics and biomedical engineering. He's a chartered engineer, a fellow of the Institution of Engineering and Technology, and the youngest person ever to become a fellow of the City and Guilds of London Institute. He's the author or co-author of a large number, 500 research papers, and has written or edited 27 books. And look at him, he's not even old yet. as well as numerous magazine and newspaper articles on scientific and general subjects. His honours include being presented with the Future of Health Technology Award from MIT in the USA, and the IEEE Senior Achievement Medal, being made an honorary member of the Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg, and receiving the Mountbatten Medal in 2008 and the Ellison Cliff Medal in 2011 from the Royal Society of Medicine. Sometimes called the first human cyborg, I don't know if we're going to get a demonstration of this, as Kevin was successful with the first extrasensory ultrasonic input for a human, and with the first purely electronic communication experiment between the nervous systems of two humans. The Institute of Physics selected Kevin as one of only seven eminent scientists to illustrate the ethical impact of scientific work and what the ethical impact that scientific work can have. The others being Galileo, Einstein, Curie, Nobel, Oppenheimer, and Rotblat. The lecture today, entitled "The Cyborg Experiments," is a talk delivered by the creator of Project Cyborg on the experiments that he's been conducting to further the exploration of cybernetics and how he became the world's first cyborg. He has said, "Shouldn't I join the ranks of philosophers and merely make unsubstantiated claims about the wonders of human consciousness? Shouldn't I stop trying to do some science and keep my head down? Indeed not. Well, here he is with his head up, in perhaps more than one meaning of that phrase. Please give a very warm welcome to Kevin Warwick.
Just need to plug into the technology first, and then we're all right. Thank you for inviting me to give a presentation here. Thank you also for making it in Wales that we have, and the one place in Wales where the water has been late arriving, so it's really nice. I have to say, when people are talking about which nationality, and people from Belgium and so on, my wife is actually from Czech Republic, who did absolutely terribly at the football last night, losing to Russia. Our house was a bit like a morgue. My family actually stem locally. I'm partially Welsh, I have to say, my father's side anyway. So I'm Welsh when the rugby is on completely. It's difficult to find somebody locally that I'm not related to. So if you do find relations all over the place locally, whether they will be, as you, friendly towards me after this morning's presentation will be interesting. Because what I'm talking about are cyborgs. Now, some of you may see this as the natural progression for humans, and you're still a human when you become a cyborg. Some of you may regard it differently, that if you're a cyborg, then you're post-human. You've evolved into something more. So from a humanist perspective, I might be your friend or I might be your enemy. What I'm looking at, as you will see, two aspects really. Where humans have some problem, particularly a neurological problem at the present time, how can we use technology to help? To provide a system, the human and technology all together, that then can do other things or can help them in their particular situation. But also it's looking at humans, particularly neurologically, mentally, as being pretty limited. We have a finite number of brain cells. We use technology externally to allow us to do all sorts of things that we can't do just with our brains. So why not link up much more closely with it? So that's what this is about, is linking much more closely with technology. So hopefully I won't upset too many people and you'll see what the possibilities might be. Just to get you into the spirit, I've put this class 2 implants, which now sounds a bit sort of techie, but this is what Barack Obama calls these things nowadays. This is all part of the Obama healthcare plan, which I will explain in a second, but I'm going to take you way back in time. I know we're supposed to be talking about the future, but I'm going to go way back into the last millennium to start with. In the mid-1990s, various scientists, Peter Cochrane, who was then head of British Telecom Research Labs, good example, saying in the future we won't need passports, we won't need credit cards, we won't need keys for our cars. What we'll have is a little implant under the skin that identifies us to the world around, computers and so on, and technology will do it for us. Nobody had actually tried it until I did. This is a young, much, much younger version of me, and this is my GP, George Boulos. This was all done care of the National Health. And what he's doing is implanting this thing, not the thing on the left-hand side. For those of you from Belgium, and this is the currency that we still, this strong currency that we still have here. And the thing on the right-hand side is a radio frequency identification device. So it identifies using radio, essentially. And this was implanted in my left arm back in 98. And what we got it to do was to link up to the computer in my building. So in doorways in the building, we have big coils of wire with current passing through them. This doesn't have a battery. The main element is a coil of wire that you can see. That's how it picks up the power. So if you have current going through wires, if you walk between the coils in the door frame, then current is induced. This is a mutual inductance, back to Michael Faraday and all that sort of thing. So it's old technology. Current is induced in the coil. That is then used to down the bottom half of the coil is an identification, a number or some sort of indicator, and that is then transmitted back to the coils in the door frame, which are linked to a computer. So the coils are used to pass power, but also to transmit messages by radio, essentially. So as I walked around the building, walked towards my laboratory, and the door opened for me automatically because the computer knew it was me. Going down the corridor, the lights came on. Coming through the front door, hello, Professor Warwick, because it knew it was me. Lately it says, hello, Kevin, because we know each other much better. So effectively, with this implant, myself and the building were one system, if you like. And various people at the time said, who's ever going to want to use anything like that? Well, I don't know, does anybody here have a cat or a dog with a chip implanted? Oh, yeah, thanks. Hey, audience participation. Yeah. Well, it's the same technology. So you can rest assured that this was fully tested on humans before your animal received it. The main use, I know one or two of you, there's a nightclub in Rotterdam, there's another one in Barcelona called the Bayer Beach Club, where you can actually get a small version of this. If you fancy trying it, try it, and they actually inject the thing, and then you get access to particular areas of this nightclub. And interestingly, you don't pay with cash for your drinks. It's automatically charged via your implant, just like Peter Cochrane predicted. But the main use now in the United States for people with diabetes and epilepsy, a lot of them now have this a smaller version of this implant. It's a bit like keeping your medical record inside your body. And then when they go and need medication in hospital, the hospital authorities know what medication to give them. So it's quite a useful, if you're in a pretty bad state, then they can get the required information. The reason that this class 2 implant thing, the recent healthcare, now it's being regulated in the United States, which is interesting, which can potentially put links in there. At the moment, if you have an implant, it must be part of the regulatory scheme. But it could go the direction, it's difficult to see with the wording, that you need, if you want healthcare, you must be regulated, and if you're to be regulated, you must be chipped, essentially. So it might be a way, ultimately, of stopping funding if people don't want the technology. So there's one thing. Now I'm going to bring you right up to date, and some of you may have felt, I wouldn't mind trying some of this cyborg stuff myself. Well, this is, instead of saying don't try this at home, I say, well, this is what you could try at home, because this is what some of my students are doing now for their undergraduate projects. And I have to say, we get ethical approval from the university for this, so this is not me being nasty and imposing things on students. I've called it sensory substitution, which you will see where we're going. So this is Jowish. Sorry if you had a lot for breakfast. It will get worse later on, I can assure you. This is Jowish, the first student, and what he's having are magnets implanted in his fingers. And one interesting thing, you'll see the guy that's doing it, look at his arm, and he's got tattoos on his arm. And that's because he is a tattoo artist. That's what his job. Now, the problem is that he goes by the name, this is true, he goes by the name of Dr. Evil. And when it comes to getting ethical approval from the university, they actually have a line which says who is carrying out the medical procedure. So you can see the difficulties we face with it. I mean, you know what the authorities are like in universities. There we go. So it makes things difficult. This is what we're doing. This is Joes as an X-ray, and you can see the magnets implanted in the fingers. And here's an example of the use. So on the baseball cap are ultrasonic sensors, sonar sensors. This is the same sense as a bat has, used a lot in robotics and tech. I think a lot of cars have ultrasonic sensors on them nowadays, which you might see. So what happens if an object comes towards the sensors, then the signal from the sensors increases. Now we're using the signal, if you look at his finger, you see a coil of wire around the finger. So the output from the ultrasonic sensors is fed down to stimulate, to provide current to stimulate the magnet in the finger. So as the current increases in the coil, the magnet vibrates more. And as the current decreases, the magnet vibrates less. As an object comes closer, the current increases, so the magnet vibrates more. As an object goes further away, so the current decreases and the magnet vibrates less. So essentially, the person can feel how far objects are away, pretty accurately when they move slightly. So you can feel it in your fingers. I know there was a song, Feel It in Your Fingers. Well, in this case, you can feel distance. Now, clearly, in the one case, you could use this for somebody who is blind. They could have this as an alternate. Instead of a white stick, they could use it to detect objects around them. And it's pretty accurate. You don't know what the objects are, but you know where they are pretty accurately. But for anybody, these students, you can try it yourself. So for all of you, it would be a different sense in a way. And we'll see more of this later on. One student now in the university, Ian Harrison, he has these implants. What he's looking at and is infrared input. Now, infrared is like a heat signal, so you can detect how hot an object is. So what he can do is remotely detect how hot an object is, which is a sense humans don't have. We can't detect from a distance. So he could literally say, you are hotter than you are, not in a sexual sense, I mean, purely please no emails. I pointed out. So he can remotely detect who's on. Now, clearly there are immediate potential applications. If you think you're a soldier and you're about to go into a room and you don't know whether anybody's in the room, then you could simply point your finger around the corner and scan, there's somebody over there, there's somebody there. So you'd know exactly where the people were before you went into the room. If they got weapons, it could be dangerous, but you know where they are. You'd also know how hot they are. I don't know whether that would be any use or not, but there we go. The next one, this is another student project. This is Ashley, and he's following up on some work that a guy called Paul Bakirita did. And it's a different way of communicating. As humans, as I'll explain later, if you're not convinced, we're not very good at communicating at all. And this is looking at an alternative route. What you see there are a number of electrodes which are placed on the tongue, and then little patterns of stimulating current are applied, very light, tickly current. And the person, very quickly, if you haven't tried this before, very quickly you can recognize letters, patterns, all sorts of pieces of information. And the interesting thing is the signals from the tongue are, the brain recognizes those signals very, very quickly. I mean, it's as fast as visual and so on. So you can respond very quickly. It could be used as a safety measure, but it's a very, very rapid response. Medically, a lot of research has been done looking at the optical input from the eyes to the brain and the auditory input from the ears, but very, very little research has been done from the tongue into the brain. So there's not a lot known. And one interesting part of this research, where it provides more questions than answers, is that if Ashley presents, let's say, a triangle shape, then the person will very quickly say, it's a triangle. But if we say, well, could you draw the triangle that you're seeing? They might draw it the correct way up, but they might draw it upside down or sideways. They could, and no matter how much we provide teaching and say, no, this is the way up, this is the way up. They recognize it. So it is a very rapid route into the brain, but it seems to be very hardwired, and it's difficult, maybe impossible, I don't know, but difficult to retrain. Why that is, we have no idea. So if in 10 years' time you see a paper with somebody explaining what it is and so on, then you'll see, I will be reading it anyway. But it's one of those things where it's a question more. But sending in signals via the tongue, again, can help people who have difficulties communicating, because you can communicate very, very quickly this way, a lot of information very quickly into the brain. And if they have problems otherwise, that can help. But again, it could be useful in the days now with cars and things like that, where you have so much information visually, the potential for providing information in a different route. So it's that bit of research which takes us into a whole different area. And this next bit is definitely a different area. One of the exciting things I get to play with in the university are small robots. And when you think of a robot, you may think of something that's programmed by a computer, or maybe it's remote controlled by a human, like the bomb disposal robots. Well, now we're looking at robots that have brains for themselves. And just to get you into that, to show you some of our robots, I've got a clip from a BBC program called Inventions That Change the World. And here you'll see the first one is a robot head called Morgui, and we're looking at integrating different sensory input. The little mobile robots that you see later on are the ones that are more important for this presentation, though.
One of the AI community's leading lights is Professor Kevin Warwick.
Well, this is a robot head.
Dissatisfied with vacuum cleaners and robot dogs, Kevin's gone one stage further. His cyborg comes complete with
radar in its nose and an infrared top lip.
Is it intelligent?
Well, in a very limited way, I guess it is. It's sort of a basic instinct. What do I do with this information that I'm getting? How do I move? How do I operate if this signal is different?
So what's it doing now?
Well, if you clap your hands...
Oi, over here. Oh, it did it.
It's making basic decisions. All we've got it doing here is programmed to make basic decisions based on that sensory information that's coming in.
Getting the information in is nothing. That's like picking up a book. That's not an intelligent thing to do. Reading the book and knowing what the words mean, that's surely the intelligence.
Many machines can read books nowadays, but it means something different electronically to the machine as it would mean to a human.
Though the cyborg head does a reasonable job of sensing, it can't really interact with or explore its surroundings. It's fastened to its robot arm. And according to Kevin, it's only as intelligent as a dishwasher.
If that's a dishwasher...
Yes.
Where are these in terms of... Are they dolphins, chimps?
I think you'd have to say it's about the 50 to 100 brain cell area. So realistically, you're talking slugs and snails.
But a slug and a snail, they know to eat. They know. These things don't...
They have some innate abilities.
There's no self-preservation with that.
Well, we do have. This, the power supply, they don't have their own batteries. They each have power they're picking up from the floor here. That's where they're getting their energy. That's where they're getting their food
from. But if you turned off this section of the floor...
If we turn off this section,
was here,
they have a basic instinct to go and look for some power somewhere
else.
They will keep going to do that until they find some.
So if I put him down...
It should go off looking.
So he'll have to go and look for power. Are they going to tell him to do that?
No, it's an innate response for that robot. It's a basic
self-preservation
thing of his life. Yeah, yeah.
Now, his lights have come back on.
Lights have come on.
So he's found power.
He's happy now that he's getting power. Away to go.
But these, then, are as intelligent as slugs.
It's different. But in terms of numbers of brain cells and that sort of thing, yeah, we have slugs. Probably you could say we're up to bees and wasps, the sort of tens of thousands of brain cells, is about as good as you can get. Yeah.
Bees and wasps.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you very much. Now, those robots you saw there have microprocessors controlling them. So it's not like one central computer. They've all got their own computers. And we can look at how they learn. Simple things like learning not to bump into each other. And it's a part of artificial intelligence. How do the machines learn? And how do they communicate with each other? Using, in this case, infrared signals, so we can get one robot teaching another robot. And then there's all sorts of questions as to what does the learning robot, how much does it believe what it's being taught in comparison with what it experiences itself. So it's good fun in an artificial intelligence sense. But what we've done now is replace the brains of those robots with biological brains, which I will explain. The right-hand side here, we see that this is the physical robot body that you were looking at. So the wheels, the ultrasonic sensors, the same ultrasonic sensors. So the physical body of the robot that you were looking at is exactly the same. What's changed, though, is the brain, the decision-making mechanism. This is MEA, which we'll see in a second, is a multi-electrode array. It's, in fact, a little dish with electrodes at the bottom of the dish. And as you see there, it says biological neural network. What we do is take brain cells, neurons, from rat embryos, separate them using enzymes, and then lay them out in this multi-electrode array. Within a few minutes, the neurons start to push out tentacles. We can look at all this happening under the microscope. They push out tentacles, which then start linking up with each other and become dendrites and axons, the inputs and outputs to the neurons. So after 7 to 10 days, we have a complex network there. The neurons have all connected up together, and what we then do is link it up to a robot body. We embody it. We give this neural network a body, which we will see. So this is the multi-electrode array. So these are electrodes here. We can then send signals into the brain, the culture, which is growing in here. These rings are called Potter rings, after Steve Potter, who first developed them. And what they are for is to stop the brain dehydrating. We have to keep it in an incubator at 37 degrees centigrade. We have to keep it moist. We feed it with minerals and nutrients every couple of days. So it needs to get minerals and so on to give it energy. The neurons then grow and develop. And as I said, after about 10 days, we will give the brain a body. And what you're going to see now is, if you like, a baby brain. So this robot has no computer controlling it. It's purely biological decision making. It aims forward and it then will detect the wall, and what we want it to do here is turn right. Great, that's what we want it to do. Then it turns round, it changes its mind, didn't have a signal, and crashes into the wall. But this is a baby robot. The brain is just starting out on its life and so on. Typically, the brain will be in the body for about 1 hour every day. And we have several different brains going on, several different cultures. So you see here, great, it turned, and here it didn't, so it crashes. So it's just starting. What we can witness, because we can look under the microscope as the brain develops day on day on day, and what we can witness is a process of learning that's called Hebbian learning. This is habitual learning. As a human, one example is if you drive a particular route and you drive the same route day after day after day, you get to a stage where, oh, I didn't even think about it. I was doing it automatically. Well, it's simply the case that in your brain, the neural pathways have strengthened and developed. Every time you drive that route, the neural pathways strengthen. It becomes more likely that you're going to do the same thing day after day. It's the same with other things, linked to smoking cigarettes and coffee, that you do something repetitively, it just becomes a habit. Well, what it is, the neural pathways in your brain are so strong that you get a certain stimulation and you do something. And that's what we can witness here. We can actually look at the neural pathways developing in our little model brain, as it were. Now I'm going to skip ahead. You've seen how it was after 10 days. This is the same robot, the same brain, after 2 months. And all it's been doing, pretty boring life if you're a robot in the brain, all it's been doing is this particular thing, all it has to learn. So you'll see how it is after 2 months. There we go. So maybe it was a bit early, but it noticed it, turned, and here we go. And very quickly you'll see this. It's quite boring, really. I have to say this robot has received a university education. And we're trying to keep it quiet from the Vice Chancellor so it doesn't charge special robot fees or anything like that. Of course, the fees will be a lot higher in Reading University, and so on we go. So you see this moving around now. This one is a good example. They don't all turn out this well. The important point is we can look at how the culture is learning and so on. One of the things we are trying to figure out is not just how it learns, but how memories are formed in the culture. If you like, the memory of in this corner and what do I do in that situation? Because at the moment, with things like Alzheimer's, dementia, they're trying to overcome the problem when you don't know exactly what the problem is difficult. And we still, what is a memory? I'm sure Richard, from a philosophical sense, Richard Dawkins, when he may have a philosophical view on it, but we don't really know what a memory is. And so we're trying to figure it out with our little model brain. If we can sort out, not necessarily exactly what a memory is, but how to keep the brain functioning so that memories can be recalled. So we can apply fresh neurons, we can apply stem cells to try and see how can we get the brain functioning so it doesn't lose some of those characteristics, and then potentially apply the same techniques to humans. But so we can experiment with our little brains here. The other thing to say, we are now, with the cultures we're developing with rat neurons, neurons, typically they have about 100,000 brain cells. So it's not like the 100 billion in a human, but 100,000 is quite a reasonable number, we feel. We're now working with another group that use a lattice structure, which allows us to grow in three dimensions, not just two dimensions. Now, from a systems point of view, that's good, because it takes the number up to 30 million. Again, it's not 100 billion, but 30 million is now quite a respectable size of brain, if you like, within a robot body. So that's what we're talking about now. The other element is that we also have human neurons, and they are surprisingly easy to buy. In fact, almost like getting them from Amazon. So what you're looking at is 30 million human neurons in a robot body. And to me, that starts to open up philosophical questions. You know, if it wasn't 30 million, if it was 100 billion human neurons in a robot body, then, you know, is it a human, or is it, you know, should it have rights? Or, I mean, is it the body that's important? If you replaced your body with a mechanical suit, would you still then be a human or not? So there's questions like that which it raises. So there we go. That's where we are with that research. There is an inherent medical underpinning to it, but there's also an experimental scientific aspect. Now let's come more directly towards medical issues that are used. And some of you may be familiar with this. There may be somebody who is a recipient in the audience, in fact. Deep brain stimulation is used for people with epilepsy, for people with clinical depression, but the main use is for people with Parkinson's disease. And what the patient receives in latter stage Parkinson's are electrodes positioned right in the central area of the brain, typically the thalamus or the subthalamic nucleus. And you see one example here. If the person has a right and left side Parkinson, they need to have two electrodes, one in either side of the brain. What happens is the surgeon, very, very small drill, will drill a hole right down into the center of the brain, and then will feed these electrodes in. Typically, there's four or six electrode tips, and the surgeon will select which one of those is the best position after the operation. So what you're going to see, to show you what's possible, and then I'll explain the work we're doing, is a patient who has Parkinson's disease. So this is a genuine patient with Parkinson's disease, and he has received the stimulating electrodes. Now, one thing to say, for those of you that are very much into evolution, you've probably wondered in humans why we have all this space here. There's not much in the way of organs. If you you can hear it's quite hollow there. Well, the reason for this is for putting pieces of technology. The power packs for the Parkinson stimulators are positioned here. So the two power packs. So you'll see the assistants inductively switch on the power packs, and then you'll see how the person is with purely electronic stimulation of his brain. So in this case, there's no the typical dopamine. There is none. It's purely electronic stimulation.
In 2 minutes, what was the status of Mr. Plasman when he was referred to us by his neurologist in Belgium? And you see him before surgery without drug, unable to stand up by himself. He's helped by Patricia Limousin, who is a neurologist in our group. And he's not able to do anything of, as he will tell you, makes your life looking like normal. He's not able to walk. He has having dystonia, which are muscular contraction, deforming the different joints, and this is the best he could do without the drugs, with the help of people around him and mainly his wife and friends. He was referred because the drugs were not working anymore. He was not having any more improvement, and as he will tell you, he was just a step to a wheelchair. This is after surgery. You see the tremor. We turn one of the two stimulators which were implanted in with electrode into his subthalamic nucleus, which is a tiny part of the brain. And you see that in a few seconds, the stimulation induces a stop of the tremor. This is still visible on the other side. We will turn on the stimulator on the right side. And you will see something even more spectacular than that. you will see that the patient feels again free, and he reset himself in his chair in the position where he feels the most comfortable. He will obey Dr. Polak in doing some tests, even if he feels that those tests are a little bit useless as compared to the feeling he has. He can do that almost normally. On the right side, and should I do it longer, as you say, and we'll show it on the other side. And then he will walk, he stood up alone, he's without any drug, you see him walking, turning. It was a few days before the Vienna meeting on movement disorder.
Now, many people benefit from this technology now, and for me it's a key drive to progress with the technological possibilities. One issue with it, however, is that it is providing quite a heavy electric current constantly, and the power packs they use, just like a battery in a torch, only last so long. And at the moment, typically the batteries will last for about 18 months to 2 years, and then the patient has to go back into hospital, and the surgeon will open them up, so it's an operation, will take the old power pack out, throw it away, and put a new power pack in place. So that's what happens now, which is quite traumatic to the patient, and there's the possibility of infection and so on. And it's, you know, surgeons, these are neurosurgeons, they're not cheap, as it were. It can be expensive. So rechargeable versions of it are not workable. Either it means the patient has to lie on a bed for about 23 hours a day so it recharges, or it could be dangerous. So patients don't want rechargeable versions. And the surgeon we work with, Tipu Aziz, at the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, he doesn't implant the rechargeable version at all because he doesn't like, you know, it's not workable. So what we're trying to do is to make the stimulator intelligent. So it only stimulates when it needs to stimulate, not all the time. But it needs to know when it needs to stimulate. So what we're doing is taking the signals from the electrodes, these are electrical signals deep in the patient's brain, and feeding them into a computer, an artificial intelligent system, which then learns to recognize the electrical activity in the subthalamic nucleus, deep in the brain, and to link it with the tremors and muscle locking that are the association with Parkinson's disease. So, and an artificial intelligent system can do that. The system, the signals are very, very complex, but it can make the link. Not only that, but one big advantage of it is that it can predict. So what the system can do is monitor the signals in real time in the person's brain and predict about 20 seconds ahead when tremors or muscle locking is going to start. So that now we're working with the surgeons to provide a feedback loop so that the stimulator just kicks in when the artificial intelligence system flags and says, right, there's going to be tremor muscle locking in 20 seconds' time. Now, fine, that's great, but it does raise all sorts of questions because what we have is an artificial intelligence system that effectively is outthinking the human brain. It's saying, in 20 seconds' time, this is going to happen, and I know about it. The patient themselves doesn't know about it, so they don't know until the tremors actually start. But the artificial intelligence system does. So it's modelling part of the human brain very accurately and then predicting what it's going to do. In this case, for positive medical use and so on and so forth. But in terms of thinking of the brain as something that, you know, no one knows what's going on in there, well, in specific areas, not only do you know, but you actually say accurately what is going to happen in the future. This is one example. With epilepsy, which we're also looking at now, there are far fewer patients with epilepsy. I know one or two of the students that I recognise from Reading in the audience. There have been one or two of my project students this year coming up with the same sort of prediction mechanism for epilepsy for the project work, that you get a much longer time period. You're not looking at seconds, you could be looking at minutes or even hours ahead when the artificial intelligence system can predict from neural activity that the person is going to have a seizure. And hence, even just getting the person to sit down because you're going to have a seizure in a few minutes could be life-saving, if any of you have seen what happens with epileptic seizures. So there we are. That's more of a therapeutic thing. To finish with, I want to look at perhaps the more exciting end of things, which is enhancement. And some of you may have thought you're quite happy being humans, you don't want to change. Well, think again, because there's all sorts of possibilities. Science fiction has picked up on memory, and some of you are getting to be my age when you start forgetting a few things. I mean, the possibility of having technology linked to your brain. The human brain isn't good at remembering things. Computers are. So why remember anything? Outsource memory requirements. Senses we've seen. Humans sense about 5%. Think about this. 5% of the signals around us through our sensory input. There's all sorts of things going on here now. We just don't know about it because we don't sense ultrasonic signals. We don't sense infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray, so it goes on. So much we don't sense at all. It's not that it's not important. It could well be important, but our lives just go on regardless of all this. So why not increase your range of senses? The biggest thing for me, though, if we're looking at enhancement, communication. Because when you think as humans, in our brains we have electrochemical signals, all sorts of things going on, ideas, concepts, emotions, feelings, all sorts of things going on in our brain, highly complex signals. And if we want to communicate those to somebody else, what do? Well, we convert them to trivial coded mechanical pressure waves. That's what I'm doing now. My mouth converts these highly complex electrochemical signals into mechanical pressure waves, which are error-prone. They travel very, very slowly. Eventually, your ears will pick the signals up and convert the mechanical signals back to electrochemical. And even if you've been married for 40 or 50 years, you say, what are you talking about? I have no idea. Well, enhance. No longer. If you can send signals directly from brain to brain, why not? The accuracy. As a lecturer in the university, the possibility of sending signals. I've just been involved marking exam papers. We won't need exams. You know they know the stuff because you've downloaded it. So the possibility of enhancing our communication, for me, is perhaps the big one. But therapy enhancement is not clearly divisible. And here, this is Campbell Aird. He lost his arm due to cancer, and he's been given this robot arm. But if you look at his human hand, there he goes, flicks the switch to control the robot hand, and he'll do it again to control the elbow. And this is all a bit, there he goes. So he's controlling the robot hand with his human hand, which seems silly, really. Surely he should be controlling the robot hand with his brain and feeling what the hand is feeling in his brain. And this is really what my main line of research is, this connecting up a bi-directional interface from the brain, the nervous system, to wires and out and back the other way. So signals out and back. Let's say for a moment we have a wonderful bi-directional interface. Then sure, we can go to somebody like Campbell or somebody who's lost a leg, and we can connect up, as long as mechanically the arm or the leg is okay, we can give somebody an artificial arm or a leg that they control from their brain. That's the therapy side of things. But what we're talking about here are brain signals, not just on the nervous system, but brain signals on wires. And if we've got signals on wires, we can go and clip on those wires and send those signals somewhere else. So what it's talking about is this arm or leg doesn't have to be attached to your body. The arm or leg can be somewhere completely different. Anywhere that the network takes you. It's still your body as far as your brain is concerned, because your brain signals are directly controlling it and feeling what it feels. It doesn't have to be an arm or leg. I mean, it could be some vehicle or wheels or whatever you want. You know, your body's your choice. So what it means is that with this technology, your brain and your body don't have to be in the same place. Your body can be wherever the network takes you, on another continent, on another planet even, if that's what you want. And you can sense or infrared or whatever, you know, your choice, tick the boxes and away to go. So what have I done in terms of this research? Here's me on the operating table, again in the Radcliffe at Oxford. Four neurosurgeons were involved with this research. I didn't need to have this from a medical point of view, so it wasn't that I had a problem we were trying to correct, but I did need to have it from a scientific point of view to research into the possibilities. This is what I had implanted. It's called the Utah Array, because that's where it's from. That's Utah, not Array. And you see it's got 100 spikes, 100 electrodes. It's also now called the Brain Gate, which some of you may have seen. This is exactly the same thing. And this was fired into the median nerves of my left arm. And it was a two-hour neurosurgical operation. For the surgeons, it was a research project as well. I said you're going to see a bit more blood, and here we go. This is my arm during the operation, and you'll see the surgeons had to make two incisions. They then pushed that tube down between the incisions and then pushed the array of electrodes down the tube. They removed the tube, hammered the electrodes into my nervous system, and then for 3 months I had the wires running up inside my arm out onto this little green connector pad. So the gold terminals on the connector pad were linked directly into my nervous system. So if I moved my arm, closed my hand, my brain signals, my neural signals, we could pick up on these terminals outside my body and literally plug me into the computer and the other way. So we could send signals from the computer into my nervous system, and it took about 6 weeks for my brain to learn to recognize the pulses. So when, I mean, we all get signals on our nervous systems, but your brain filters them out. In this case, I was looking to learn the signals, but it took 6 weeks for me to learn the new signals. And now I'll give you some idea of what we're able to do. And the next clip you're going to see is from Discovery TV, which encapsulates some of the things.
One man in tune with technology is the world's first cyborg.
Sorry about that. Let's try and... a slight technical jip. Oh, dear. Go back. Sorry about this. Let's try again. I found the mouse.
One man in tune with technology is the world's first cyborg. Part man, part machine. Kevin Warwick, cybernetics professor at Reading University, England, took a leap into the future as long ago as 2002. For 3 months, a silicon chip was implanted into the nerves in his arm.
At that time, no human had had an implant of this type before.
It was a procedure that until then had only been tested on chickens.
Would the body reject it? Would it affect the way I moved or my sensory capabilities? I could have lost the use of my hand. Could it affect my brain? Ultimately, could have sent me crazy.
Kevin was plugged into a computer which monitored the nerve signals from his brain to his arm, receiving and transmitting them as radio waves. With the signals from his brain, Kevin could not only turn on lights, he could control a wheelchair. And from 5,000 kilometers away via the internet, he succeeded in getting a robot hand to mimic his own hand movements. His most impressive experiment involved his wife, Irena, also having a chip implanted in her arm.
The communication experiment between myself and Irena was vitally important to me. This was the highlight of the whole experiment.
Kevin wanted to discover if it was possible for his brain to receive and feel signals from Irena's brain.
When Irena first moved her hand. It actually felt like a charge running up my index finger. It was a phenomenal feeling. Literally, every time she moved, my brain received a signal. There we were communicating for the first time in the world, nervous system to nervous system.
It was the first time two people had electronically communicated by thought alone.
In the short term, we're going to see implants used to help people who are paralyzed switch on lights, operate the TV just by thinking about it.
In 30 years, he believes we'll all have chips in our brains.
But ultimately, having extra memory, having downloads from the computer, uploading from the brain. Earth is going to be controlled by cyborgs. Humans are going to be something of a subspecies.
We'll be half man, half machine, with super memory, super senses and superpowers.
I think quite clearly that's where we're going. Superhuman.
So a bit of Nietzschean philosophy. Just a few holiday snaps to finish with. This is from the experiment. You see the ultrasonic sensors on the baseball cap. In this case, they were fed down via the implant into my nervous system. So what was happening essentially in this case, when an object came closer, my brain was receiving pulses of current that increased in frequency the closer an object came, and then decreased, so if the object went further away. So with the blindfold on, I was able to move around and detect objects. Now, it's not that you can detect, oh, this is 2.54 metres away. It's that you don't have the numbers like that. You just know where it is. If there's a slight movement towards you or away from you, you can pick it up very accurately. So it's quite cool having an ultrasonic sense, for those of you interested. This is my wife, who's with me today, and she's wearing some jewellery that a student at the Royal College of Art in London put together. The jewellery changes colour from red to blue, and it was linked to my nervous system. So signals on my nervous system gave the colour of the jewellery that my wife was wearing. I think if you can imagine the scene now, I'm calm and relaxed. My wife's jewellery is blue. I start to get excited and my wife's jewellery flashes red. And now she works in an office, nothing to do with the university. There she is in her office, the jewellery's blue. Right, he's not doing anything he shouldn't. And then you can see where this is going, I think. It starts flashing red. What is he doing? And perhaps more importantly, who is he doing it with? And maybe not such a good idea, that one. This was taken at Columbia University, New York, where we plugged my nervous system live, real time, into the internet and linked to the robot hand, which was back in Reading, in that other country just down the road in England. And when I moved my hand like that in New York, my brain signals went across the internet to move the robot hand. When the robot hand gripped an object, signals were sent back from the fingertips of the robot hand across the internet to stimulate my nervous system in New York. So I could feel how much force the robot hand was applying on another continent. So some of you thought that stuff was science fiction when I mentioned it. It's not. It's science fact. Now, some of you may have seen about 3 weeks ago, there was a woman who was paralyzed. This is work from America, who had received an implant, and she was able to control a robot hand, and it was feeding her and so on. So they were showing how it could help somebody who was paralyzed and couldn't move. Well, it was exactly the same implant, using directly for therapeutic purposes, doing the same sort of thing that we were looking at there a few years ago. So the Americans have eventually got round to doing it. The final one, though, this is the communication experiment. This is something you can try tonight, if you like. What my wife had were electrodes pushed into her nervous system from the outside. If you try it tonight, you will find it is extremely painful. And we thought she was going to get anaesthetic, but the doctor that did it said, no, I need to make sure I've made a good contact here. So he pushed the electrode in, and she screamed, and the doctor said, oh, I think we've made a good contact there. He pushed another electrode in, same screaming. We went back to the laboratory and electrically linked our nervous systems together. So what happened was every time my wife closed her hand, my brain received a pulse. So literally, doop, 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 three pulses. And what we had done effectively was to communicate directly, nervous system to nervous system, telegraphically, if you know the Morse code type of communication. Well, that's what we had done directly, nervous system to nervous system, for the first time, and we did it in the UK and so on. There we go. So it's looking at the future of communication, not just nervous system to nervous system, but brain to brain. And I have to say, although I'm very much on for that experiment, sending signals from to and from my brain and somebody else's, my wife for some reason feels it's a bit too dangerous, so I am looking for a volunteer to be the other person. So hopefully you've enjoyed that tour of cyborg experiments that are ongoing. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Kevin. We've got some time for questions now, and we've got mics which can go out to you in the audience. Please say who you are when you want to ask your question. Do you want to select the people yourself?
No, you do. People will dislike you rather than disliking me.
Gentleman on the aisle, just here, in the blue shirt. Is it switched on?
It's better if you do it by implant, actually.
Switched on now. Hi, Mike Suri. I just wanted to ask, when you said there was an interesting bit about adding extra sensory perception, infrared, X-ray, that's all very well. What about the capacity to deal with it? In other words, overloading the kind of processor part of the brain. You know, we've got smell, sound, yeah, all the rest of it going on. Add a couple more and are we going to get headaches?
Well, I mean, the simple answer is we don't know, other than by experimenting. I mean, I think the brain is a very mercenary thing. It will get into things if it wants to get into things, and if it doesn't find there's much use for something, it probably wouldn't do something. So, I mean, let's say the remote heat sense. Fine. Maybe through evolution we've not had a sense like that. So giving yourself a sense like that, the brain would probably, well, can I make use of it? Can I understand the signals? Is it of relevance? If it makes use of it and it's relevant, or it's fun or whatever, then for whatever reason, then it probably would, you know, the neural processes would strengthen and it would become a better and more recognizable sense. Whether you would lose anything in response, we don't know. I mean, you know, and what you might lose, whether it's of value or whatever, it does raise questions, you know, in my mind. Would I give my little finger to have an X-ray sense, let's say, you know, for, in theory? No, it's an interesting thing. What might you trade off in that sense? I'm saying purely in terms of the neural processes doing something, but I think it would be something that is not of that much use. I mean, if you compare the human sense of smell, I think it often people lose it, or it really goes and diminishes as they get older. You don't tend to use it that much anyway in present-day society. And again, with hearing, it diminishes and so on. So there's various things with the senses that we have that neurons might well skip over. But we don't know. It's just purely experiment and find out and see.
Gentleman on the aisle just down here.
Yeah.
Second, third row.
With the fancy waistcoat.
That's right.
Yeah. Hi. Right. Needless to say, fantastic presentation. Really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
But say if this were to become quite widespread throughout the United Kingdom and everyone were to have access to this technology, you know, like computers can be hacked. Is it possible someone can hack into you and make you rob from a bank or something like that?
Completely, yes.
Yeah. I mean, is there any sense of control that you could, you know, perhaps say no to someone accessing you or... I'm not sure how really.
I mean, I think you are you are looking at more of a negative aspect to it. But I mean, even now, people that have the Parkinson stimulator, and you know, when I no matter how much I look at that, I'm still moved about the effect that technology can have. But the potential is there now. Even now, with there are wires, they can pick up stray signals of something going horribly wrong. Could happen. Even now with that. But what you're looking at here with the work we're doing, picking up the signals from the brain, I mean, literally, we can be looking in Reading at what's going on in the brain of someone in Oxford in real time. So that's, I mean, this is purely for Parkinson's, you know, it's for a particular purpose. But if you then open it up and say, well, we've got more widespread implants and there's all sorts of information, then it does mean security will have to be much, much tighter. There's no question about it. But, I mean, I see that not as a negative, but as an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing here, if we can start communicating in this way and so on, then it's an extremely powerful thing. But it also opens up a lot of commercial opportunities. Mm. And if we can do it before someone else, you know, it's here where we make the money and we, you know, we get the thing from it. So, yes, there are issues with it, clearly, as to how do you protect the signals in terms of when they're transmitted from person to person and so on. So there's a lot more issues in security. But we still need to get the basic technology working first. So don't be quite so negative. You know, look at it as an opportunity rather than a...
Oh, yeah, definitely. I can see that. But I'm just thinking of my computer. Sometimes my friend loves messing about with me, hacking my computer temper and stuff like that. So I'm just thinking, if I had that in me, he could be controlling me. I'm thinking, wow, what's happening over here now?
Well, there might be special, if you like, husband and wife systems. You know, I think there are times when my wife would like to, you know, press the button and, you know, washing up, that's it. Special. So, I mean, we can work on that.
No, one thing I can imagine is, like, say, for instance, if I was going down to the road shopping and I was thinking, oh, I forgot what to get. Now I communicate with my mother, oh, do you want to get milk or do you want to get coffee? I don't know.
Yeah,
so that'd be a definitely useful thing. But
it would,
that'd be fantastic. I think if it would become widespread, as you mentioned earlier, it'd be amazing. Like, but
so you can looking at opportunities.
Yeah,
as well,
definitely.
Which is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
As example of that, I have a list of all the messages my wife sent to me on my texting on my mobile phone, and a large number of them are you on vibrate? Question from the gentleman in the middle there, next to the lady with the lovely blue jacket.
Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating. I'm a cardiologist. But when I was a medical student, I was fascinated by neurology and the working of the mind. And I wanted to be a neurologist. And then I was working for a neurologist and as his registrar. And I got so disillusioned because really so little I could do to help my patients. That's when I changed to cardiology. So I say that your work is just phenomenal. I mean, I looked at it and I see all the various pathologies, the peripheral neuropathies, the strokes, etc., can be done. And that is just fascinating. And secondly, may I say that you mentioned about the device for Parkinsonism, which fails, the battery lasts very long, not very much. But I look back in cardiology and I say that I look at the pacemakers that were there at one time, and I used to put pacemakers in that were huge.
Yeah.
And they should last 5 years at the most. Now you have these little ones that are there for years and years and years. And I'm sure that is going to come as well for Parkinsonism.
Yeah, I hope so. And in which case, some of what we're doing there for the intelligence stimulator could be redundant in that sense. I mean, even now, when it's implanted, it's usually latter stage Parkinson, and you may only have, I hate to say it, but you may only have 3 or 4 years left to live anyway. So how long the batteries, it's not like the battery's got to last 30 years, but in some patients it might have to. However, it is opening up a view on what's going on in the brain, and the hope is that with this like 20-second prediction, the question is what's happening with the signals in the brain? We know they're there, we know they're meaningful, and now they're going, and in 20 seconds' time, the tremors will happen. So can we figure out the route through the brain and what's happening, the cycles that are locking in? Can we figure out more of what's going on and possibly treat it in another, you know, in a different way? We may even do it something completely different, stopping it before it starts almost, via a different route. So simply understanding a lot more deeply of what's going on is clearly a part of that.
My congratulations to you. Fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Lady in the row just behind where the gentleman was just now.
Sorry, I think we've got time for one more question. So... so long as it's short.
Oh, yes, we've only got... Yeah, it's gone quickly.
So I'll try and keep this short. Kevin, my congratulations. Oh, absolutely fascinating stuff. In a completely different realm, I'm thinking space missions, Mars program, exploring the universe. Are you already working with colleagues in different faculties and different universities with this sort of application in mind?
I mean, just firstly, to pick up on that, the space programs, putting humans into space doubles the cost, you know, because of all keeping the humans alive. So and there's a drive to make it more robot explorers and so on. But this does mean that you can have the astronaut can stay at home in Houston or wherever, and then, you know, it can be somewhere nice. So one of my colleagues has just moved to Houston and he's shown a picture of it covered in fog and things like that. So reference to him. But you can stay somewhere, but your parts of your body can be on the distant planet. There is a time delay, but I think it's something largely you can get to learn about. Certainly from my New York to Reading, I was able to adjust to it to a certain extent. I think it opens up possibilities. I don't know that I can see specific dangers associated with it. I would like to come from a different angle, though, because to me, when I look at where we are as humans, we've hardly been anywhere. We've travelled to the moon so far, which is... it's almost like the sort of outside toilet to the Earth. It's hardly anywhere. And when you look at all the planets that we can't go there. One of the key drivers here, linking your brain to a computer, is the power of the computer to understand things in more dimensions. And if we can do that, physicists talk of 12, 13 dimensions. Human brain, sorry to say it, but it thinks in 3D. That's it. So if we can start understanding things in more dimensions, I would hope it might open up that we might actually travel there in other, you know, the wormholes that scientists talk of, that we can actually experience those if we understand the world in a more complex way. Now, that is a very arm-waving Sheldon Cooper approach to the situation, but, you know, you have to, as a scientist, you know, maybe we can do that. So that would be my ultimate hope, that we can understand things in a more complex way by linking to technology more. But thank you for the point.
Thank you very much for those stimulating questions. And Kevin, thank you very much for a very good talk.
And that's it. If you'd like to listen to our regular weekly program, just head to poddelusion.co.uk. There you will also find the other talks from the BHA 2012 conference, including Sir David King and Ben Hammersley. Thanks for listening.